Welcome to Edu Leadership Radio. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and my goal in each episode is to bring you the best in professional practice from real school leaders. My guest this week is Rob Ackerman. Rob is an elementary principal in Massachusetts, and our topic is collecting and using the right kinds of data in your school. Rob, thank you very much for joining us. Do you want to start by telling us a little bit about your school context?
Yes, so my school is located about 10, 15 miles outside of Boston in the town of Bedford, Massachusetts, right near Lexington and Concord, where kind of all the American Revolutionary interesting things took place. And I'm the principal here of a grade 3 through 5 school, approximately 550 students. And we're in a fairly affluent town, but still a good amount of diversity here. And we consider ourselves a strong school district and a strong school with high expectations for students and staff.
Great, thanks. So we've been chatting a little bit online about the use of data and yep. And what kinds of data are most worth collecting. And I also am an elementary school principal and am continually thinking about whether I'm collecting the right kinds of data and with the right frequency. And what do you see as some of the trade-offs with collecting data? What are the factors that you have to balance?
Yeah, well, I share the same struggles with you. There are a lot of good can be done with data, but you can also waste a lot of time with it. And I think one of the areas where I've clearly moved away from and is just this use of the state testing for all your data analysis, because it comes to us in a neatly tied package, in the way it's at least in Massachusetts, the way we can analyze it is very easy with just the technology tool we have. But it doesn't make sense for us to put so much effort and so much time into just analyzing one test, where it can come down to just one or two questions for certain standards. So we make unfortunately, a lot of schools make a lot of decisions based on these state tests, and I think they need to broaden their horizons as far as the data they're using.
And how fast do you get that state test data back? Is it the following school year when that comes in? Or?
No, Massachusetts, we have preliminary data already from this previous spring. We already have it, except Great. For some of the short answer questions for the math. But right now, I already know how every student has done for ELA for those tests. And the math one, I have all of the multiple choice scores already here. Wow. And if it was 5 or 6 years ago, I probably would have already had all of these tests completely analyzed. And I could have told you the exact standards that students fared better in or worse in. But now, I simply don't put as much weight into it as I used to. We'll still look at it. We'll still analyzing it, but not to the extent that I would have in years past.
I see. So you're a grades 3 through 5 school. So do you have that data on all students? Do pretty much all of the students in your school take some sort of state test?
Yeah. So every single student. Right now I could literally pull up in front of me the scores from the state test. How they did on every single question, and for these of an ELA, if they're proficient, needs improvement or advanced, or whatever category they might fall in.
Right. So I think one of the complaints that I hear most often from educators, especially principals and teachers, is once we get that state test data, the students have already moved on to a new teacher, a new grade level,
exactly.
And there's not the opportunity within the school year to address the needs of those specific students.
Right.
Have you found any ways to kind of pass that student-specific data on to the next year's teachers, or do you use it mostly at the kind of strategic level and say what do we need to work on as a school?
I think we definitely don't use it as much at the individual level, unless from a kind of a final score we will. If a kid happened to fail it, for example, that would certainly send a huge red flag to us.
Right.
But we're looking at more, from the 30,000 feet up in the air, and just kind of, in general, how's our school doing? In general, what are areas where we seem to have strength, where we seem to have... And you're right. Getting the scores over the summer, it's a quick turnaround. I have them, but, school's not in session now. When the kids return, they're in a different grade. They're in it with a different classroom teacher. So it's still, it's a real challenge to really use these in any meaningful way. I think we've got to be honest with ourselves. It's really hard to do it, particularly when we're doing, you know, our own pre-assessments come September in a variety of subjects. We're going to have that data with us as well. So then, you know, I think in many ways that's data we would start looking towards more than the MCAS that was taken the previous March or early April.
Right. So in my state, we have this saying that the state standards, the learning expectations,
yep,
are the curriculum. And
yep,
the specific things that we use, like, say, our purchased math curriculum or our reading materials, those are curricular materials, not the actual curriculum itself. And I have, you know, some little qualms with that, or some little disagreements with that.
Yeah.
But I'm curious as to your thoughts on how well those state assessments really map to the actual curriculum that you as a school intend to teach. Do you feel,
yeah,
like there's a good mapping, or do you think there's
some
deviation?
You know, I think the tests, I think they're fair tests. I don't have any problem with the actual Massachusetts tests themselves. It's again, I still think it's just how much weight do we put into them that I have more of a problem with. You know, I don't think it's not asking too much for our students to read a short reading passage and answer some questions and, you know, answer a long response, you know, using evidence from the text. I think that's a skill that we all agree that the students in the upper elementary level, we want them to be able to do.
Sure.
That's certainly, you know, a state standard and something that we, you know, basically most people in Massachusetts can agree on. My problem is more is what we do with it afterwards. But as far as our tests, by and large, I think people, from what I hear in our district, you know, think the tests are fair. And that certainly there's nothing usually that's on the tests that's out of left field or we're completely surprised at. But obviously some of the curriculum we do here is also not on the test. And that's, you know, that's where you got to be confident enough in what you're doing and making the right educational choices that it's okay for us to do certain curriculum in a subject area that it's also not on our state tests. And I don't want to we're not a test prep factory or anything like that.
Right, and I think that's really where I think we have to look at ourselves, you know, from an integrity,
yeah,
standpoint and say, what do we really believe is necessary to teach students, even if it's not going to be tested, even if there's not going to be any,
yeah,
you know, kind of test-driven reward for teaching,
yeah,
it. It's the right thing to do, and that's
exactly
why it's worth spending the time on.
Yeah. So, and school leaders, I think, you know, we got to be able to, you know, communicate to our staff, you know, I think downplay in many ways the significance of the state test and let them know that, you know, we can build our own, you know, important and valid tests in-house, because not as if testing is a bad thing in general, but and there's some piece of curriculum that's not on the state test, but we also think it's really important. We can still do it, but we also should work up our own assessment internally to see how the kids are faring on it.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Obviously, the state tests are, you know, only done once a year and don't provide you with,
yeah,
the kind of just-in-time information,
yeah,
that you need in order to reteach or to more immediately meet students' needs. What, yeah, do you do within the school year on a more frequent basis to assess where students are,
well,
in their learning?
You know, I think like many other schools, you know, we've been influenced by the work out there talking about common assessments. And so we've clearly moved in that direction. We're in better shape in certain subjects relative to others. And for math, you know, all our students in the grades are taking the same common unit assessment. Those that data is collected in-house. As a principal, I'm able to look at that, you know, on spreadsheets to see what's – we have a certain proficiency mark, a cutoff that we've designated as our proficiency, our standard for being proficient. And so for math, we're able to do that. We have common writing assessments that are more quarterly throughout the year, and we've just made some strides this past year to get our science and social studies headed in that direction. So in pre-assessment wise, we have a, you know, a boatload of common assessments. It's the during the year, whatever you want to call them, whether you want to call them formative assessments or summative, what terms you want to use, I just like to say common assessments, and we use this data to impact the student learning.
Right. So if I'm hearing you right, those common assessments are made by the teachers in your school,
yeah,
to assess the curriculum that they're,
yep,
you know, they're working on together. Okay,
exactly.
Oh, did you get any pushback you know, when doing that for the first time, or was that pretty widely agreed upon that
no,
was a good
thing
to do?
No, I think it's always scary for teachers in general, because there's this feeling that, you know, that people are paying attention to exactly how these students are doing, and you know, in simple terms, well, my principal is going to see how these kids are actually doing on the assessments. I think that's a scary feeling, because it's not the way a lot of teachers have been trained. It's not what the teachers were used to, maybe, you know, in their own school experience. So it's new, and I'd be lying if I said everyone kind of jumped on board all happy with it. Some people believe in it, others, you know, they're still kind of apprehensive, but what's clear is that we're moving in that direction, so there's no turning back from it.
Sure.
And particularly with the new, you know, the new evaluation tools for teachers that are coming in the near future. You know, a lot of districts are going to start having to use their own internal common assessments as part of the evaluation. Otherwise, they're simply going to be relying on the state tests, and that's I don't think anyone would think that that's a good idea for evaluating teachers.
Right. I'm thinking back to my experience as a science teacher. I taught 6th and 7th grade science. And
yep.
I don't know that we ever did any real common assessments as far as things that we came up with.
Right.
But in terms of giving the same assessment and then discussing the results, one of the things that I think was most distracting to us was just any kind of problem we had with a particular question, or any kind of argument about the wording, and saying, oh, well, I don't think that's really a fair question.
Yeah.
I think it's confusing. And
from what
you're saying about teachers developing their own assessments, it seems like that concern would really evaporate, would really disappear, because there's nobody else to, you know, to point
right.
the finger
at. They can't kind of throw out that excuse or get sidetracked like you're saying. I think you're right. And, you know, if you have a large grade level, which we do here, about eight classrooms, you know, it's still hard to get everyone to agree that this is, you know, the perfect test and every question is worded perfectly. But I think there's still, you know, in general, they agree that it's a fair test. And if they didn't, then, you know, the other teachers would be more than happy to look at it again. And the tests, they're continually looked at on a year-to-year basis. We don't pretend they're perfect. So there often questions might be reworded for the following year, or we might delete a question or add something else in. So they're constantly being changed in that sense, too.
Great. Now, this sounds a little bit parallel to the idea of end-of-course assessments, which a lot of districts are developing. And and one criticism that I've heard from high school teachers of end-of-course assessments, particularly when they're developed at the school level or by a department, is that they tend to reflect the priorities of whoever's kind of the most senior member on the team. And one of the specific criticisms I've heard is that they tend to assess whatever the most powerful teacher on the team is best at teaching or most prefers to teach. I'm curious what the process has looked like in your school for how those assessments are created, so that they reflect some kind of shared priorities.
No, that's a very interesting point. I don't feel like it's at this elementary level. I mean, obviously at every grade level in every school, you're going to have teachers that are more vocal than others, more experienced than others. But I feel that, you know, our teachers, you know, they do a good job of listening to each other. We have some curriculum leaders that are able to guide the process, and they're well respected. So I think that's an important piece of it. If you can have those people in place, not that they're complete experts, but that they have a body of knowledge that most of our teachers agree might be, you know, more extensive than the typical classroom teacher. And so they kind of follow their lead, but they're not afraid to speak up at the same time. I think we've been fortunate not to encounter that. But I could see how some schools could encounter that, maybe more so at a high school level. But even if there was a real strong-minded or very vocal elementary teacher, I could see that happening. But I guess I'm lucky that it hasn't happened here.
Right. And I think, by and large, most people do want to collaborate. Most people do want to be on the same page with their colleagues so that they have, you know, something common to discuss, and they can learn from each other and build on each other's success.
Exactly.
Yeah. And in terms of developing common assessments at a grade level for a particular subject area, how do you recommend that other principals or other schools start? You know, what's the best place to start? And what is a reasonable amount to do in one school year? Obviously, this is something that you've built up over time. What do the first steps look like?
I would say pick one subject. Often math lends itself to to this because we often think of math as it's in units already. Usually there's some type of program that you're using, even though you might be throwing in your own piece of that. But pick a subject and, you know, pick X amount of units, whether it's three, maybe you try to put together one in the fall, one in the winter, one in the spring. But the main thing is just really focusing on, you know, what we're assessing is what we really care about, which is, you know, the big ideas, the central components to these units. And so, you know, once you have that down, then you have to think, okay, what are the types of questions we need to ask to get at this information? And that can be difficult. It's not easy, and I'm certainly not an expert on it, you know, but think about, how do we ask this type of question? Is it going to be in a word, you know, if it's math, is it a word problem form? Is it straight, you know, straight computation? You know, there's a lot to consider, and teachers, you know, often don't have training in writing test questions, so it's a learning process for everyone. But it's, I would start small. I would pick a subject and just pick a couple units within that. And then, you know, I think it's a great thing to do for summer work for school districts, to get some teachers to meet over the summer to kind of hammer out these types of common assessments and then bring them back to their team in September to get some feedback.
Absolutely. I love that idea of starting with math, particularly because there's kind of less there's less argument about what it looks like and what success looks like.
Don't start with social studies.
Yeah, and I found reading definitely to be the most sacred to people. That's reading should probably be the last. There should be a track record of success before getting to reading, just because I think people hold that so close and so deeply. With math in our district, we have district math coaches and just a tremendous central office math department that's developed some really good assessments that are based on the published curriculum that we purchase, which is Everyday Math from the Chicago Mathematics Project. And they have modified those to better meet our state standards and to, you know, kind of plug some gaps. And then one of the things that we've realized in using those and in making some tweaks to better get at what our students are learning is, you know, a lot of assessments are really designed to trick students. And if we're really trying to figure out what exactly students know and what they don't know, a lot of the times the best way to figure that out is with a very straightforward question. So when we look at our end of unit assessments or our kind of mid-year assessments, a lot of the times the questions on them are very simple in terms of getting at the actual concept that is being assessed, because it's a very different purpose from a standardized test whose purpose is to kind of distribute students along a bell curve and rank students and figure out who's at the top, who's in the middle, who's at the bottom. In the classroom, we're much more interested in who knows it and who doesn't and what can we do about it.
Yeah, we're okay with everyone getting it right. Whereas the state test, you know, they don't want everyone to get it right, or it's no longer a question the following year. It's considered too easy.
Right.
No, I think it's a great point. There's no trickery involved. It's straightforward, and that's an excellent point. And I'd be curious at your school if, because that these assessments came from central office, how much buy-in there was with the teachers.
I would say the major feeling among teachers about these assessments that are written at the central office, you know, speaking particularly to math, is just one of relief that the bulk of the work has been done. Because as you said, it is difficult, it is time consuming, and it's not necessarily where people want to spend all of their effort. So I think honestly, people really like being able to kind of pick it out and look over it, and certainly they read it over carefully and make sure that they agree with what it's asking and that the questions are fair, and certainly have no problem with grabbing the whiteout and changing a question if it is too tricky, or if it is you know, indirectly assessing something else rather than what we really want to know.
No, that's good.
And I wonder if we could talk next about how we actually use that data. You know, what does the teaming look like? What does the discussion look like? And what do the what does the follow up look like with students based on that data?
Yeah, that's where everyone kind of stumbles a bit, and we don't exactly have it completely down pat here. But the first you got to collect the data, which for us is having the teachers just input it on a shared spreadsheet, which is on a shared drive, so teachers can access it and I can access it as a principal. And then depending on the subject, we gather, if it's math, you know, this past year, I would meet with the our curriculum coordinator for math and look at the scores, the preliminary scores, and then we would look at kids that struggled, and then go back to those teachers to figure out how can we help these kids. Do they need extra services in some way? Not necessarily special ed services, but just extra support in some way. We also look if there seems to be a pattern where just our whole grade level didn't do well. Next year, which will be nice, is we're going to do this at the grade level, because what's difficult is you got to carve out the time to do this.
Right.
You have to get people around the table. It sounds so basic, and I think the corporate world would laugh at us, but schools aren't really good at finding time to get, you know, 8 classroom teachers to sit around a table to look at the data. So as we head to next year, we have training going on for one data leader at each grade level, where they'll learn how to facilitate these meetings. And then they will be able to bring the data to the meeting. We have to make sure it's in a form that's easy for the teachers to understand, preferably some type of graph, because I think that's important. You can be overwhelmed just looking at numbers on a spreadsheet. And to begin to ask kind of the critical questions, but to make sure, as they often talk about, that we're asking about what can we do as adults to help these kids and get away from blaming the kids for the data. You know, we still often in conversations will hear that, you know, so-and-so is not doing his homework, or so-and-so has been absent too much, or he doesn't pay attention in class. And we're trying to get away from those types of issues and really focus on just what can we do as adults and as a school. So I think our structure is going to be better next year, because we specifically as a district have carved out time. Every Wednesday we're going to have an early dismissal at our school. And so there's going to be time designated for us to actually sit around and look at the data. It's a priority, and our superintendent asked for that in the new teacher contract, which will make a huge difference for our school next year.
Yeah, I think that's critical to really provide the time. Because as I look at the, you know, the workload of teachers in the U.S. and compare to teachers in other countries, and particularly professionals in other industries, college professors and so forth,
right.
I really think elementary teachers have less preparation and collaborative time than virtually anybody else. You know, just to be on for all but, you know, 30 or 40, 45 minutes a day, and then be expected to use that little bit of time that's left to collaborate. You know, I would love to see a workload that was 50% prep and collaboration and 50% teaching. I don't think we'll be there in my lifetime.
And to be honest, one of the ways I got teachers to even just inputting their scores in a shared spreadsheet, I mean, that's work for the teachers, is that we then changed from a quarterly report card system to a trimester. So the trade-off was, you know, I'm reducing one, you know, batch of report cards that you need to do, because I'm now asking you to, you know, take on some work with inputting scores can be kind of a tedious task.
Sure.
So I think principals constantly have to be looking, you know, to what can they take off the teachers' plates to make it a little easier for them to handle. But you're right, there's never going to be a good enough amount of prep time for the teachers. It's so true.
Yeah, so I think, I guess whatever it is that we do with data has to also solve a practical problem, you know, in teachers' daily work, you know, whether it's reducing the amount of prep that they have to do because they can get ideas quickly from other people,
right.
Whether it's just starting with one, you know, one subject per year and building that over time.
Another way I also think about data is that schools, they don't do a good job of selling themselves. And what schools, particularly elementary schools, because we don't have graduation rates or anything, is that we often rely on the local newspapers to just, you know, publish our state scores. And therefore, you know, that's how people often will judge you. And so, you know, I think part of also a principal's job is to make sure that, you know, you're using even some of the in-house data to kind of help sell your school. And you can say, look, our, you know, we have, you know, 90% of our grade 4 students are proficient on, you know, our in-house common assessment for math or whatever it might be. Because otherwise, if we don't sell our schools, then someone else is identifying, you know, is kind of labeling them or selling them for us. And it just makes sense with all the technology we have and the ways of communicating that I know you're all aware of. There's just great ways that we can use a lot of data and also surveys that we do to help sell our schools. So that's another piece of the data, is just, you know, the student learning, but there's also surveys. I mean, I send out every year a survey to parents that basically, it's only a minimal amount of questions, basically asking, you know, how are we doing? because what better way to get it? And that's another way that we're able to sell ourselves, and I'll print the results on my blog or on the school website so everyone can find out that way.
Right, great, great. So I think there's one potentially difficult issue that comes up when we're using common assessments and
yep.
comparing data across classrooms, and that is the potential for this kind of awkward comparison. You know, if I see that you across the hall from me are being twice as effective at
yep.
Teaching a particular topic.
Yeah.
How does that make me feel, and how do we deal with that potential for yep. difference? Because I think we really like to feel like we're equal. We mm-hmm. like to feel like we're all doing an equally good job. And
yeah.
You talked about getting away from blaming students for those differences.
Right.
How do you handle that culturally with that potential for comparisons to be drawn between teachers that are visible to them?
Right now, the teachers do not see. We're not at a point where I'm comfortable handing out. A bar graph showing, the five different classrooms and, the level of proficiency in each classroom. We're not there yet. It takes a lot of comfort and trust between the teachers. You know, in an ideal world, we'd be doing that.
Right.
But I think if you just start, randomly handing out the scores to everyone, it's not going to go well.
Right.
And there's always a fear that teachers have, the principal can use this, against them,
right.
That other teachers can think, they're not as effective a teacher. And also, our classrooms, they're never going to be perfectly equal with the makeup of the students in them also. So that's what I hope is that teachers can at least begin to get in the conversation of, I did this particular lesson, I used this strategy with my students and they seem to do really well with it. And, I'd like to share that with you guys. And if, that we can get teachers comfortable enough to do that. But again, the corporate world, I think, would laugh at educators. Most schools aren't at a point where that can be an easy conversation. And I think it's just part of the nature of the job and that we really haven't focused on that. But getting to a point where we can pass out, the five different classrooms and their scores, we're not there yet. And I doubt a lot of schools are.
Right, and I think it's wise to be sensitive to that and to
yeah.
not try to be, too hard about the data and to push
yeah.
too far, because
right.
ultimately I think we want to do this to help teachers learn, to help
right.
principals learn from, from what that data tells us and from the collaboration that results. So certainly
exactly.
paying attention to the social cues and the cultural norms that are at work
yeah.
and those
yep.
social dynamics is really wise. So
Definitely.
Well, thanks so much for your time today,
okay.
and it's really been a pleasure to speak with you.
I have one last question for you. I had mentioned about the Evernote for walkthroughs.
Sure.
And you're using that, you said?
I am.
Okay, and I'm thinking of using it next year. It seems like, I read some of your posts on it, and it seems like it's a good tool for that. I just didn't know how well you think you're going to continue with it for next year also.
I will, yeah. I found
okay.
it really to be just kind of a no-brainer in terms of storing the information that I need. So,
yeah.
You've got your walkthroughs and you've got your kind of mini observations and then your more formal
yeah.
observations. And I have really gotten into the habit of just putting all of those into Evernote just
yeah.
as kind of plain text documents. And
right.
This past year, we got a new evaluation system with a new rubric that's based on Charlotte Danielson's framework for
okay.
effective teaching.
And
yeah. I converted that from, the kind of complicated Microsoft Word table into
yeah.
just a plain text outline. And if I'm doing a longer observation or more formal observation, I will actually type what I see under the appropriate bullet in that outline.
Do that in Evernote?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I just paste in the plain text, so it's not a complicated layout of a document. It's just a new line for a new element.
Yeah.
And what I found that lets me do is really structure my feedback around that framework, because we're using
okay.
that for our evaluations and for the basis
yeah.
of our professional growth. And knowing what to look for, I think, for me, is half the battle, because you go into
yeah.
a classroom and you see 1,000 different things going on. So really
yeah.
focusing on what do I want to provide feedback on, how can I collect evidence? Part of the job of the principal under this new evaluation system really is to collect evidence you know, for all these different criteria that were not the basis of our evaluations previously.
Right.
So one of the things that I've found Evernote to be really helpful for is pulling all of that evidence into one place. So what I'll do when I'm writing a year-end evaluation is I will just search Evernote for that teacher's name, and you know, I'll get 5, 6, 10, 12 different notes that I've taken over the course of the year, and I'll think, wow, did I get anything on, you know, classroom management? Maybe not in formal observation, maybe I was more paying more attention to something else, but I'll look back, and maybe on a walkthrough, maybe I got some great data on, some great evidence on classroom management, and I have it all in one place. The really nice thing for me about using Evernote is that I don't have to spend any time filing. I don't have to spend any time searching. It, you know, it just comes up immediately. And I can even copy and paste, you know, into my evaluation. So, you know, I used to use more paper. I used to use, you know, different forms and things like that. But I've found that, that having just that plain text in Evernote really translates well into both the written evaluations and just to the informal feedback. You know, if I want to send a quick email saying, hey, you know, I saw this happening today, way to go, let me know if there's anything I can do to support you. That's really easy to do from Evernote, and I just usually copy and paste what I wrote into an email on my computer or on my iPad, and it's always there. So I use the iPad. I've been using a wireless keyboard to go with that, and I found that to be a great system.
Okay, well, yeah, I'm trying it out thanks to you, so I appreciate it. Yeah, enjoy your writings. You know, I follow you where you write, so, you know, keep it up.
Well, thanks. Let me know how it goes, and let me know if you have any insights on that.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for your time,
Rob.
Bye-bye. See ya. This week's episode of EduLeadership Radio is sponsored by the Principal Center, bringing you the best in professional practice for school leaders. If you are tired of reinventing the wheel when it comes to answering an email or coming up with a newsletter article, this is the place to be. It is launching soon. It will be $10 a month. Right now we're in private beta, and you can get on our mailing list at www.principalcenter.com and find out how you can get a free membership for life. So check it out, principalcenter.com.